I'd like to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm Curator of Education, and it is such a pleasure to be a part of this program. Tuesday Evenings is an ongoing series with artists, art scholars of all stripes here each week. We have only a few more, so I encourage you to get online and see what the lineup is. I also want to use this opportunity to remind you that we're still doing the Sundays with the Modern, which is an ongoing tour series where we have artists and art scholars come and talk about special exhibition, the aspects of the architecture, permanent collection. It's a real treat, and it happens every Sunday at 1 p.m., We meet, you can ask at the info desk where we're meeting. We'll either be at the top of the stairs or at the bottom of the stairs. And it is free with the cost of admission. So making it free, of course, for members, and free on the first Sunday of each month. I also want to remind you of the final graduate student lecture. We've been announcing those each week. The last one will be this Saturday. So I encourage you, if you've gone to any of them, you know how good they are and how nice it is to encourage graduate students in this program by attending. So I invite you to do that as well. You'll find that information online. Next week for the Tuesday evening series, we have Jerry and Jean Jones. We'll be here visiting with our chief curator, Michael Opping. They're going to talk about the Joneses' art collection and specifically the choices they made for the Cowboy Stadium's state-of-the-art collection. And I have to say, I saw that today, and it is, in fact, a state-of-the-art collection. It is a collection that, of course, includes the work of tonight's speaker. And as you are fully aware, we are an incredibly, incredibly fortunate group of people because tonight we get to hear from one of the pioneers of the conceptual art movement of the 1960s. With his 1968 statement of intent, Lawrence Wiener revolutionized contemplation, using language as material for subject, defining art as representation of relationships in the physical world. In his own words, the relationship of human beings to objects and objects to objects in relation to human beings. And then there are, in addition to, of course, the fact that language is sculpture in this case, there are the unromanticized implications of the words and the relationships that he chooses. It's such a bold and meaningful contribution, and it has, of course, been recognized with international exhibitions that actually boggle the mind. I believe the solo exhibitions were 26 pages long. So if we're going to get to Lawrence's lecture tonight, I'm not going to run through them. He has participated in Documenta 5, 6, and 7, as well as 2005 and the 2007 Venice Biennale, and the 2006 Biennale Sao Paulo. His many honors include the 1976 and 1983 NEA Arts Fellowships, a Guggenheim Fellowship in 1994, the Wolfgang Hahn Prize of 1995, and a Skowhegan Medal for Painting Conceptual Art in 1999. In 2007, the Whitney Museum of American Art had the great insight to organize an absolutely brilliant retrospective titled As Far as the Eye Can See. That exhibition traveled to the MoCA in L.A. in 2008. I hope some of you got to see that exhibition. It was, in fact, remarkable. An exhibition for which Roberta Smith of the New York Times called A Wake-Up Call and Purification Rite All in One. And I think she hit the nail on the head. And the list, of course, goes on and on. He is currently working on a book and, if I understood, a film. And this year he has a show in Utrecht in the Netherlands and in Zurich. And he's currently working on an exhibition at Marion Goodman, which opens in December. I cannot believe he accepted my invitation to be here tonight, but I could not be more grateful. And of course, there is the wonderful one lump, two lump, three lumps, four that belongs to this museum and is in this collection. You're familiar with it, having been in the cafe where it was beautiful, and being the gracious artist that he is. Lawrence, in fact, loved that sighting. And as I understand, he also approves of the new siding, which is in Gallery 5. And I invite you to go see it because, as I said, it's kind of interesting, the implication of relationships and how those words seem to take on perhaps a different meaning in a different location. And, of course, that piece brings me to tonight's talk because Lawrence has titled his presentation tonight, One Lump, Two Lumps, Three Lumps, Four. He's going to, I believe, show us some very special films and talk to us about his ideas and the things that interest him. I said I can't imagine a better evening. So if you would, please join me in welcoming Lawrence Weiner.
Well, I'm afraid you probably know everything about me now. There's not much more to say. I don't know. What the role of the artist is within our society at this time, we've reached a very strange state where I'm a useful human being. I don't find what I have to say not interesting. But I'm much more useful if I can talk about things that other people are curious about, because I've had this very lucky sort of situation. I entered into the art world at a time when the art world was developing itself within the United States in the late 50s. And there was no school systems in that time, really. There were some places, but those were genuinely for privileged people, essentially. So the rest of it was lacking any kind of a structure and completely dependent upon the generosity, as Tennessee Williams did in his autobiography, The Generosity of Strangers. I don't know where I'm supposed to begin tonight. I brought a little cartoon. I got an award from the BAFTA. The BAFTA is the British Academy Awards for design and things. I make movies as well. And this was for design and for other things. And I didn't know, again, what I was supposed to do to get up, to break the ice, to get to the point of having a conversation with the people who've come. So I made a little cartoon, and it's a kitchen table cartoon. And it's 5 minutes. And if you'll bear with me, we'll just run the cartoon, and then afterwards, perhaps, the conversation can begin. Would you be kind enough, number one, please? As I realize how many other speakers have been. A few proposals as to why we are all here and perhaps as to where we're all going are in order. Roma, can we please have some music? Art is not a metaphor upon the relationships of human beings to objects and objects to objects in relation to human beings, but a representation of an empirical existing fact. It does not tell the potential and capabilities of an object, material, but presents
presents a reality concerning that relationship. Constant placation of previous aesthetics consumes present resources to the extent that as the needs and desires of a present aesthetic make themselves felt, the resources have been exhausted. Present aesthetic, that's us. Reality is no different than any other reality. It is the content that gives the perceptions and observations of an artist within the presentation art a use factor within the society. The acceptance of the need for this distancing by a society, in fact, the need itself by a society for its art to function, has led to the misconception that art and artists are apart from society unless they do not function as artists. There are very few material relationships of human beings to objects that at various some stages have not required various some form of human being to human being relationship. The utilization of media presents these various relationships at the moment of the presentation of what, in essence, is a material relationship. The utilization of media as both presentation and representation seems to require no justification other than the presentation itself. Change in the relationship of art to a culture is perhaps that the explanation, the not needed justification, of the existence of art has been allied to the concept of production. This reading, while obviating some form of social unease, is not in fact the case. Art is in relation to its society a service industry.
I thought that that probably would cover giving some sort of sense of where I stood. There is a difficulty for artists as they get long in the tooth. You've participated in things, you've done things, and it all begins to build up as if it's an authority. And that's not the situation that I find myself in. I think I know what I'm doing most of the time. But I never taught, even though there were economic reasons for doing it. Because one of the things a teacher really must do is take on the responsibility of the students and have authority. And one of the few things that I can't do as an artist is have authority. I've been working for the last 4 or 5 years on a body of work that has to do with the idea of multiple realities. That there is no Aristotelian logic based into our world, that in fact there is no parallel realities. When there's a parallel reality, it's always something is a shadow of something, something is a reflection of something, something is not quite right. If there's multiple realities, and the old thing of how many angels can dance on a pinhead, you don't have to have a hierarchy. That what happens at this moment, here and there and there and there, is happening at the same time, at the same point of time, and probably in the same place. And if that's so, this non-hierarchical idea of material, that lead is not better than steel, and steel is not better than oil paint, etc., leads one to a point where the logic structure we are imposing and we're presenting to the world does not allow for most of the things that go on in the world. There cannot be a hierarchy. My difficulty in a talk like this is that I've been a lucky person. I've been able to put the work out in the world. And that does the talking for me. I don't have any soap to sell. People like, we're talking, I think, what is it, 50 years ago? Yeah, it's a long time ago. How long? 40 years, 45 years. When there were a lot of artists showing work that didn't quite fit in at the time. That's a very long time ago. And you can't talk about anybody as being sons of the pioneers or things like that. You can't talk about that because it doesn't make any sense. What happened was there was a change in a mentality. And that mentality meant that art was about the relationships of human beings to objects. It was about now. It's not about then. I just had to do a little talk with the people from the Cowboys Stadium because I did a piece there. And they were talking about past, present, and future. And I realized I don't believe in the present. I have no idea what it means. By the time I'm talking to you or you about it, it's the past. I can believe in the future, but I really don't care about that. I don't know what I care about at this point as an artist. As an artist, your relationship to the world is almost to lay things out for people and, in fact, help them to find their own place in the sun by realizing their relationships to objects. If I'm to be of any use, I have another cartoon with me, but I'll show it a bit later. If I'm to be of any use to anybody here, as an artist, and I'm pleased and proud to be an artist, it really would be to be talking about things that interested the people who are here would be a conversation. Lucy Lepard, a very good critic, very nice person, she's living in this area nowadays, as far as I know, somewhere around Santa Fe, which is all part of the Southwest. But she was, well, it is, I'm sorry, I'm from New York City. I was born and raised in New York, and I keep a foot in Amsterdam because I wanted my daughter to grow up with a foot in the old world and a foot in the new world. But she once went up in front of an audience, and it was sometime in the 60s. She stood there, and at that moment she was this hotshot critic, and there she was, and she looked at the audience and said, "Any questions?" And there were none. I could do that too. But I'd like to say, are there any questions? Everybody's here because they have some vague idea of what I've done or who I am. And as I said, with the internet nowadays, everybody knows what everybody's done, more or less. I have seen things of mine on YouTube that maybe I'm getting old, but I don't remember having made. Some of them were even sort of interesting. But if I'm here, and I am, why don't we look for somebody with a little bit of courage and ask some questions and start a conversation, and maybe we can turn it around. I have a lot to say about a lot of things, but I don't quite know where to start. I don't have a formal lecture. I mean, I can give you one if you like about Aristotle and the idea of Aristotelian logic not quite working, and let's take the bagel from Hegel. It all sounds very good, and in fact, it makes a lot of sense. But I'd much rather be of some use. I saw a hand. Oh, Michael, of course. In-house shill.
I guess what I would like to ask is, where, on a basic level, where the language comes from? And you could say, well, the language comes from the culture. I'm just going to sort of ask a question and fall off a cliff and try to make some wings in a question while I do it. But Dan Graham has said that conceptual art is really a sort of an outgrowth of pop art in the sense of vernacular imagery, and in your case, perhaps vernacular language. And I guess my basic question is, does the language come from the material you refer to, or does the language come from a kind of vernacular that you hear in the world? Does that make any sense?
Oh, it makes sense, but you're asking me to tell you where something comes from. I can only tell you why I use language and what the decision was. You can't see anything. You see this. Everything you see in the world, you give a name to. It has every culture, every country, it has a name. But a piece of wood in Senegal and a piece of wood in Tokyo and a piece of wood in Scandinavia doesn't look the same, but in fact it's a piece of wood. At the time I began to try to make art, I was involved in meeting people who basically knew exactly what they were doing. And they were special. When their hand touched something, it became special. And I'm terribly sorry, maybe it was a vulgar, crude person, but I didn't see the special. I saw stone, steel, iron, wood. And some of it was exciting and some of it was not. The use of language frees you from that. All children see things and give them names. Dan Graham's speaking about so-called pop art, so-called conceptual art. That may be fine for Dan Graham, but my relationship with pop artists at the time in the 50s was really, I was really quite enamored of their skill as painters, and I found them quite intellectually interesting people. Nothing to do with what I do. It was a coexistence, again, simultaneous at the same time. I don't see things as outgrowths. That would be a strategy. And we can always go back to paraphrasing Janis Joplin. Strategy is just another word for nothing else to lose. Strategy, we're now at the most complicated time of contemporary art in the Western world that we've ever had. Art has been taken out of the hands of people trying desperately to set up another logic structure, and has been taken over by the academy. And the problem with that is not that the academy is evil or there's anything particularly right or wrong with it. The job of the academy is to give answers, and at the very least to pose solutions. The job of artists is to ask questions. They're totally antithetical. They don't have anything to do with each other. The role of art is to pose things by presentation, not imposition, to people that pose questions. I was asked to be on an interview once when I did the manhole covers in New York City, and that's in direct line with another and the next, and there's 19 of them. There were supposed to be 20, but the people installing them came banging on the door of the studio, scaring the life out of an assistant of mine, and I was traveling, and said, there's the guy who did this, he lives here, yeah. And there was this big greasy thing hanging there, and they said, yes, and they said, well, it's a good project, he ought to have one of them. And they started to clean it, and they left it there, and it weighs 350 pounds. But New York One was asking me questions, and it was cable, the beginning of cable in those days. You could say anything you want, so your language was not a problem. And they said, you know, look, we know you, you're an angry person, you're a New York person, you're involved in politics and civil rights, da-da-da-da-da. Why is this so quietly laid just in the street? And I had to think. I didn't have an answer. And I realized that I was becoming furious with most of my colleagues who thought they had the right to run out in the street and do things to people. And it's public. So as public art, I realized that I don't want to fuck up anybody's day on their way to work. I want to fuck up their whole life. And if that's not a reason to make art, I don't know what is. that, I mean, it's very hard. I'm standing here. I'm not running for public office. Thank heaven I'm not looking for a job, which at this time, day and age, is a major concern. But I really and truly think that the whole purpose of making art, the only reason we should be doing it, is to be placing things into the world that pose logic problems for people, that make people question their own sense of their own value in their own world, the world that they can see and they can touch. Artists make things that people can see and that people can touch. My using language does not take it out of that realm of seeing, touching, and otherwise. It's just another aspect of it. The sensuality is there. Art is essentially sensual. When it ceases being sensual, it becomes illustrative, becomes illustration. I loved illustrated books when I was a child. I loved classic comics. You could get the whole story, and then you could read the language, and you didn't even have to pay attention to the story anymore. You could just get into the language. But that's still just illustration. And that's maybe not what art's about. But I think we need another question than Michael's. Does anybody have anything that they're curious about? Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about, well, first of all, with the multiple realities that,
yes,
that you're interested in now, I'm interested in that process of you coming to a realization or recognizing something that you've always known, or in both now with the multiple realities and also at the moment when you realize that many colored objects placed one after the other,
placed side by side to form a row of many colored objects.
When you realize that that was sculpture and that that was, I know you're not one to receive compliments, but that was a pretty profound moment when you began to use language as material and present that work as sculpture. Can you talk about those two moments of kind of coming to that realization that language could be a material for sculpture, and the moment that you're in now where you're realizing that it's this multiple reality, and maybe how are we as, I mean, how are we going to handle that, being that we don't appreciate chaos? You know,
multiple realities have nothing to do with chaos. Multiple realities have to do with the reason for making any form of art. It's to enhance and give dignity to objects and materials. It's nothing whatever to do with chaos. Chaos has to do with another set of questions. Chaos theory, in fact, doesn't have anything to do with chaos. Chaos theory is trying to figure out why it's so warm now, and could it really be a wind farm that's taking away the roof? Nobody gave any dignity. Okay, my generation, and I hate the word, by the way, generation. If you're standing on a street corner and you have to cross, I've said this before, you have to cross the street, and there's somebody that's 90, 80, 70, all the way down the line, and you make it across the street without getting hit by the bus, you're all in the same generation. It's that simple, and that's for artists, for everybody else. Artists' reality is no different than anybody else's reality. We're not special people. We've just chosen to spend our time looking at other things as mathematicians have, as dental researchers have, as anybody has. But this thing about wanting to know where the primacy comes, it was not so complicated. You have to take it out of a concept when there was a market-driven concept of the new, and look at it in terms of a lot of people not quite sure what it was. We were talking earlier today, and what came up was a funny thing. I grew up at a time in New York City And because I worked on the docks at night when I was a kid, I hung out in bars and I met a lot of abstract expressionist painters and a lot of other people. So my entrance into the world was not just people like myself trying to screw the world or do something. There was no upsetment when I even finally was taken into legitimate places to show. It was only the frightened people, all the people that were doing something, were saying things like, hey, kid, you know, everybody says you're out of your mind, but you're not out of your mind, but how are you going to make a living? That was their only concern. There was no hatred. There was no violence until we got to the graduate school of people. Once they started pumping them out, then there was competition. Art's not about competition. Art's about being right and being wrong. It's that simple. And art is a profession. You go up on a wire. And if you're wrong, you fall down. And you get hurt. And if you're right, you get to the other end of the wire. And do you know what that does? That lets you talk to the other people and make something new that got to the other end of the wire. Art does not essentially give you anything that you don't already have. It helps you to place it within a context of your life. I make art that has no metaphor. None of the works of mine have a double meaning. In language, you can make double meanings out of things, but then you look at what it's saying it's making. There's no double meaning whatsoever. Anybody coming to it from any culture, which was one of the reasons, Michael, that I chose to use language, I had decided that I wanted to make art in the world, not just in New York City or Los Angeles. And in doing that, you don't make something with a metaphor. You let people come to art who have needs and desires and trying to figure out their own place in the world and bring their needs and desires, and they make a metaphor out of what you have made. If you have a metaphor, each succeeding group of people that find your work, I'm trying to avoid using the word generations, then does not have to accept your value structure in order to use it. Doesn't have to accept your logic structure in order to use it. Doesn't have to accept your lifestyle in order to use it. You are putting out something. There is a generosity to the making of art. You're trying to destroy what you're seeing. And I'm convinced that all art is made from anger. You are very angry. One is angry with the configuration that's presented to you of the world, the way things are read and done. And in that anger, you try to build another configuration, but without the anger against the configuration, if you're just doing it to enter into another so-called line of things that might have worked maybe a year after Giotto, but it didn't work afterwards either. Art has continually presented not other realities, but other means of using reality. And I think I'm going to show another cartoon for 5 minutes, if nobody minds. It's this one that it's going to be in a show that I'm doing in New York now, and we've just finished it. And I brought it only because there's a movie I just did for Anna Sanders in Paris, and they just had to negotiate to get the rights to get part of this little cartoon that we're going to show. So do bear with me for 5 minutes. May I have the second one, please? It's silent, so you can chatter with each other. So you're my Toronto. There's always, when you have a film that you're not quite sure, a film, they show it in Toronto to see how it works. That's where my mind is right now. I'm trying to determine. But as far as all of this leading up to, let's pose some funny little questions. Why was it possible for somebody making work like I was making in the late 60s to be hanging next to a Robert Ryman, to be showing next to this? Why was it possible for me to be showing with a Chamberlain, with a this one, with a that one? Why was it not exclusive, and why was it not? It was attacked, but not rejected. And that's the interesting part of the whole deal. That people were attacking it, that people were hoping this was not the way art was going to be. And it turned out it wasn't the way art was going to be, it was the way art was. But it was other ways too at the same time. Can't get any questions out of you, can I? Oh, thank you. Did you want a June wedding or?
You said early on that you are not sure where you're going, what you're interested in.
Yeah.
You said that at the beginning of your talk. Did you feel that way at the beginning of your career? Did you feel a sense of certainty? Because your work seems very certain. It feels like you have a direction you want to go. How did that work?
It still works that way. I don't put anything out in the public. I don't put anything out that I'm not sure of. I could be wrong, but I'm not that I'm sure of. How does that work? You'll have to take the problem that we're looking at is how things entered into a culture, but you'll have to look at the culture that it entered into. If, in fact, there was a context. There was a dreadful war going on in the end of the 60s. The country was in an absolute disaster. It was a much different time than it is now. Schools were closing down, not because of economics, but because they couldn't come to a reconciliation of what it was they were supposed to be teaching. Social unstrife and social strife and such was so totally different. Now everything is really just people's opinions. And I'm at a point in my life where I would like to see art, with all of the advantages that art has right now of being part of the mainstream culture, be able to stand up and be what it is. Very much like Galileo or so must have felt, that why not just throw this into the mix and see whether it really does work. And instead, what I'm beginning to look at is a necessity at this point to step forward, not aside. So I'm just speaking now personally, but there's a problem when you get asked to go and stand in front of people and talk about things. You never really quite know how you're going to feel, and that's how I'm feeling. I don't know. I never do anything in public I'm not sure of. Only because the conversation is supposed to be about what it says, not who I am or what I'm thinking. And when you're not sure of something, then you have to engage somebody into it, and it becomes dreadful, and it doesn't work. Art is something that's lying there on the floor, and nobody has to know a damn thing about it. In talking about the Dallas Cowboys this afternoon on this interview thing, I realized that nobody coming to the Cowboy Stadium has to know anything about art. It's right there. It's up on the wall. Do they have to know when it says, you know, selling them Frankfurters? It doesn't have to. You don't have to know a thing. Everything is explicit. Good art is explicit. You can look at a Jackson Pollock and not know anything about art and know exactly what you're looking at. And if you don't have a use for it, you walk away. And a work of mine, if you don't have a use for it, you walk away. Maybe you come back another time. But it's all about a person coming to art and having a need to have another logic structure presented to them. A means and a way. So that's the best answer I can give you to your question. I hope it's an answer.
Thank you.
Oh, Michael. No, this gentleman, please.
How important is the visual element of your work, the letter shape of the fonts and the color and things like that?
Initially, I didn't think it was going to be so important, and I forgot that I had some kind of a basic craft built into me as a person. I do it as a means of trying to find a non-authoritative, extremely sensual, pretty way of putting things out. So fonts are important to me. That's why I designed the Margaret Seaworthy Gothic. And at the same time, it's just like when you dress to go out. If you were going to do something, you basically dress yourself. When you put out a work, you basically dress it. The fonts and the things have no inherent meaning. In fact, it's red as well as green as well as blue. Color has a meaning in various times, but it has no inherent meaning in an installation of mine. It's an attempt to place it within a context that the content will be seen with the least amount of problems, and not carrying with it any kind of authority or things like a Helvetica or something like that.
So you want it to be fairly invisible?
Invisible and sensual at the same time. Like Greer Garson. No, I mean that seriously. It's all of these illusions. We live in a strange kind of a world where if you're lucky, you're confronted by a Greer Garson that you don't quite realize is gorgeous. You function with it and then you turn around and you realize that it is, and it's nice when you get a font. It's like the little cartoons, and they're just they're intentionally kitchen table, but they function. And they'll function on any machine, any place. And it's a means of presenting instead of writing an essay. Michael.
As an extension of his question in regards to how do you do it, these formal issues, in these cartoons it becomes very clear that lines become very important,
yes.
Color becomes important, font becomes important. Do you do this as drawings on paper?
Mm-hmm.
Do you work on a computer at all?
No.
No, you don't have any?
No, I design occasionally a program for somebody to use, but I don't. But that's a personal thing. I was involved in the early, if you remember, with Adaweb. We did Homeport, which is still floating around somewhere. But there's nobody talking. It was a chat palace, and I have no idea how people find it or still use it, but it's there. No, that's only because otherwise I'd spend all of my time talking to people. No, email is a terror when you make your living and you do your work. In an international situation, it's much better to see it in hard copy than it is to sit down at the machine. And then I'll answer and I'll do things. But as far as these things go, I draw them. And we try... Remember, the computer is a wonderful thing because it's the least oppressive tool that we've ever found. It really doesn't care. It's just that it's been programmed because of economics not to do certain things unless you pay for them. But in fact, most of the computers can do everything. You just have to figure out how to ask it to do it without it knowing you're asking it to do it. And it does it. It's an equal opportunities employer. It's true, you know that. Sometimes you'll find yourself with a program that's not going to do it because you have to go further and get another program. But you ask it to do something that's sort of like it, and with pleasure it does it. It's not always malevolent. No, but I did draw it out. As a matter of fact, I'm going to show the drawings for this last cartoon at Marion Goodman. Yes?
You were talking earlier about language and how various words that we use for things, like stone, wood, etc., they all can look different or are different to each individual. That seems to me that it would lend itself to infinite, you know, opportunity.